From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we meet one of the greatest basketball players in the history of the game, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. He retired last season after 20 years in the NBA. Imogen Coca is reuniting with Sid Caesar for a series of performances. Coming up, she looks back on her days as one of TV's first comedy stars. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new reissue featuring Czech conductor Václav Talich, performing works by Dvorak and Smetana. And we remember singer Sarah Vaughan. She died last night at the age of 66. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev has warned the Baltic Republic of Estonia against taking steps toward gaining independence. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
The leader of the Estonian parliament, Arnold Rutel, told the parliament in Tallinn today that Gorbachev said he would take the same steps against Estonia that have been taken against Lithuania if Estonia does not back off of recent declarations of its intention to pursue independence. The warning came in a telephone call from Gorbachev last night. During the past week, the Estonian parliament has said it intends to follow a slow route to independence. And earlier this week, it also declared that it does not recognize the legality of Moscow's authority on the territory of Estonia. Over the past week, Moscow has beefed up its military capacity in Lithuania and seized some key buildings there. Presumably, these are the actions Gorbachev is threatening to take against Estonia. In his telephone call to Estonia, Gorbachev also summoned the Estonian leader to Moscow to discuss the republic's recent moves. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
Lithuania accused Moscow today of trying to overthrow its government. The Lithuanian parliament passed a resolution charging that the Soviets were using the army to try to restore political structures that existed before the new government came to power in February. In London today, a Lithuanian spokesman said that his country would consider a temporary halt in its moves toward independence if it would avert a major crisis. In a fierce counteroffensive, Cambodian government troops have bombarded and seized the biggest town controlled by U.S.-backed Cambodian guerrillas. Today, shelling continued to rock the last important town under guerrilla control and pounded the guerrillas' military headquarters. Mary Kay Magstead reports from Bangkok.
Last September, Vietnamese troops ended their 11-year occupation of Cambodia, and three Cambodian guerrilla factions promptly moved in to carve themselves a liberated zone. But now Cambodian government troops seem determined to drive the guerrillas right back into Thailand. In the past 24 hours, the government troops used heavy rocket, tank, and infantry assaults to seize Tamar Puk, the guerrillas' biggest strategic town. Shelling continued today. It was aimed at the guerrillas' military headquarters and at the ancient village Bante Chamar. Western aid workers on the Thai-Cambodian border said the shelling was so heavy they could feel their houses shake. Meanwhile, resistance figure Prince Norodom Sihanouk returned from a visit to China to his liberated zone home. But his aides admitted that the government's current offensive may wipe that liberated zone off the map and force the prince to flee. For National Public Radio, I'm Mary Kay Magstead in Bangkok.
Stock prices fell today on Wall Street, hit by rumors that the losses on Tokyo's stock market had produced a cash crisis at a major Japanese financial firm. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell nearly 18 points to close at 2,719.37. Declines led advances 9-5. This is NPR News. The U.S. government said today that a deadline for disarming the Nicaraguan Contra rebels would not solve the Contra problem. The State Department was responding to a call from five Central American presidents yesterday to demobilize the Contras by April 25th. That's when the U.S.-backed government of Violeta Chamorro is due to take office. State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler said today that an expanded United Nations force should be deployed right away in order to verify a mutual ceasefire and separate the forces. President Bush today met with a bipartisan group of senators to thank them for their work in passing a landmark clean air bill. NPR's White House correspondent Phyllis Crockett reports.
The president met with 16 Senate leaders, including Majority Leader George Mitchell and Minority Leader Robert Dole. They were instrumental in breaking the legislative logjam and adopting the first clean air bill in 13 years. Mitchell says he will try to toughen the bill in negotiations with the House. President Bush has threatened to veto any bill that costs industry too much. In today's meeting, he again brought up his concerns.
That we can have cleaner air and a growing economy which continues to produce jobs for the American people. And in that respect, there's no question that the Senate bill is a major step forward, but it is only a first step.
The president said his administration will work to make sure the ultimate bill produced by the conference committee is one he wants. I'm Phyllis Crockett at the White House.
The Senate today confirmed a 44-year-old labor law attorney to head the nation's program to rescue the ailing savings and loan industry. President Bush's nominee to head the Office of Thrift Supervision, Timothy Ryan, was confirmed on a vote of 62-37. He won confirmation despite complaints from Democrats that he lacked banking experience. Supporters stressed his experience as a manager. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is one of basketball's giants in stature and height. The 7'2" athlete holds the record for Most Valuable Player Award, he won six times, and holds the record for scoring the most points in playoff games. Abdul-Jabbar played in the NBA for 20 years, first with the Milwaukee Bucks, then the LA Lakers. He retired last year, and he's just published a diary he kept of his last season in basketball. It's titled Kareem. During his last five seasons, he was the oldest player in the NBA. I asked him what kept him in the game so long.
Basically, I was enjoying the success that the Lakers were having. We had phenomenal professional success. My last 5 years in the NBA, we played for the world championship four times, and we won it three times. And that's nothing to walk away from.
You had a lot of friends who retired from basketball. What did you think about when you saw them leave the game and saw the direction that their lives headed in?
Well, I really wasn't able to keep track of them. They get away from the game, you don't see them because the game just dominates your life. It dominates all your time. You don't really have time to keep up with acquaintances.
There were comments in the press during your last year that you weren't playing your best game, and you had said in one article that you felt that you didn't prepare that well for the season. How did you feel about that press response during part of that last year when there were criticisms about your performance?
Well, I didn't like being criticized, but I had to admit that their criticisms were valid. I really wasn't contributing that much, and it was difficult for the team to get used to what they could expect from me. You know, one day I'd be okay, and the next day I'd be very mediocre. And it was really troubling, and there was nothing I could do about it.
Did you ever feel during your last few years that your body was letting you down? You'd been playing basketball most of your life. And, you know, you'd played when you were very young, and now you were, you know, the oldest player in the NBA. I mean, how did you feel about your body?
I felt real good about my body. Everybody else my age had been gone and had turned into looking like pears and everything. I felt pretty good about my body. It was really your mind goes first as far as, like, your will to pay the price for preparation. That's the first thing that goes is your mind. You say, hey, I don't need this. I've done it enough. And that was the thing I had to constantly combat, you know, just tossing it in because I'd achieved everything, and I was only trying to achieve it one more time.
My guest is Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who has a new autobiography out called Kareem. It's actually a journal of his last year in the game. Now, the move that you've really been most famous for is the skyhook, and you say in your new book that you really felt that that helped give you the longevity that you wanted. Why did that move have longevity that other specialties wouldn't have?
Well, you know, when you play close to the basket, that's where all the big bodies are, and that's where all the pain is dealt out, and that's where people usually end up bleeding if it's going to happen. And it's just a very physical game inside, and the hook shot enabled me to score when I felt appropriate and not have to go head-to-head against a very physical opponent. I could shoot it over the defenses, and because people had to respect it, it created problems. The other teams would have to double-team, and, you know, my passing could take effect at that point. So it really was a staple of my ability to play.
I have to say that when you walked into the radio station today, everybody was coming up to me and saying, "We know he's tall, but he's really tall." You know, because everybody had seen you on TV, but no one had met you, and, you know, from the radio station face to face, and everybody was just still felt unprepared for how tall you were. When you were young and you were shooting up in height, what effect did it have on you? You were always the tallest in your class.
Yeah, well, it made me very shy. I wasn't, when I was a young child, I wasn't that shy. I was very outgoing and gregarious. And then the height factor kind of pushed me inside a lot, and it took me a long time to overcome that.
What year or what period was it that you really started to shoot up?
Let me see. In 2.5 years, I grew 10 inches. I went from like 6'1 to 6'11, right between the 7th and 9th grades.
Did kids make fun of you for being tall?
Not really. I enjoyed my height, basically, and I was so into athletics and so active that I was real tall, but I wasn't gangly and awkward. I could keep up with everybody. I could play all the games that we played. We played stickball and ringolevio and handball and basketball and baseball. And I was into all of that, and I was just a tall kid.
Did you stand up straight, or did you slouch over to cover up your height a little bit?
My mother would not let me slouch over. That's what she did, and she has her posture has been permanently affected because she grew to her adult height before she was 15. And, you know, she's almost 6 feet tall. And she has a permanent slouch, and she was determined that wouldn't happen to me.
Hmm. You say that some of the referees treated your height like it was an unfair advantage. Are there ways that you feel that you were almost penalized in the game for being as tall as you are?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think that's just a basic fact of human nature. If you are put in a position to judge things, you want everything to be even, especially if it's an athletic contest. And for basketball, height is definitely an advantage. And a lot of times, especially I would say in college more so than the pros, because there are a lot of tall men in the pros, but in college and high school, I always had to deal with the fact that the referees were going to give the other team more opportunities to foul and restrict my abilities as much as they could.
What about dunking?
Well, the rules committee eliminated dunking from college basketball in 1967. So I think that lasted for about 10 years. So my last 2 years of college ball, no one could dunk.
Did you feel you had anything to do with that?
I knew I did. Uh-huh. Yeah, I think that rule was aimed directly at me. But it was still a level field in the fact that no one else could dunk. So I just adjusted, and it probably helped my game by making me think about diversifying.
Do you think that players have gotten taller in basketball than they were when you started out?
There are a lot of taller players now. I mean, people haven't gotten taller, but tall young men are pursuing basketball earlier, and they've become better athletes at it as a result. So you see more basketball players, and they are getting taller.
Now, so how did that change how you played the game? You know, because when you left, you were probably the tallest. And I mean, when you started, you were probably the tallest. And by the time you left, I mean, it wasn't that uncommon to be your height.
When I came in the league, I was the tallest center in the league. And when I retired, I was just an average height center.
So how did that change your game and also your view of yourself?
Well, you know, I have always had to make adjustments to the competition, and I just viewed that as part of the game. It really didn't have any effect on me one way or another. I just took that as part of what I had to do to compete.
Mm-hmm. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is my guest, and he's written a new memoir called Kareem. I think you were the second famous athlete, the first after Ali, to change to a Muslim name, to become a Muslim and to have a Muslim name. Now, Muhammad Ali got a lot of criticism for it, because he was the first star athlete to do it, and I think a lot of people really didn't understand it at the time. What was the reaction when you changed your name from Lew Alcindor to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar?
I don't think it really shocked people that much. I think Muhammad Ali got all the criticism because of his stance on the Vietnam War, which was very unpopular when he originally took it. Of course, eventually people came around to his way of thinking on that, but initially he had to deal with all of that. I didn't have that problem. I wasn't taking an unpopular stance. I wasn't political with it. It was just a very personal thing that had to do with my freedom of religious choice. And I just tried to keep it on that level. I didn't want to make a political statement of it. It had a little bit to do with Black pride, but I wasn't waving a banner and causing any type of controversy with it.
You were a Muslim for a couple of years and had your Muslim name before you used it publicly. What made you decide to actually change publicly?
Well, I just felt that I was going to continue with this faith, and I had made a commitment, and I just gave myself a few years to change my mind, and I didn't. I got more convinced that I was doing the right thing.
Now, the name that you dropped, Alcindor, you explain in your book that the Alcindor name was the plantation owner, the name of the plantation owner in the islands that brought your family over from Africa.
From West Africa, yeah.
So did you feel like happy to lose that name, even though your parents had had it?
Yeah, I felt that it really wasn't that big a part of me. I'm still a member of the Alcindor family, but I've taken my own identity, and I want to affirm that identity.
When you became a Muslim, did that set you apart from the team in certain ways? Because there were certain activities that you weren't going to participate in.
Well, basically it was just alcohol. That's something I don't indulge in. But for the most part, I still was one of the guys. I didn't try to set myself apart.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and he's written a new memoir called Kareem. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is my guest, and his new book, Kareem, is about his last season in the NBA. And during his career, he played more games and scored more points than any other player in NBA history. You became a Muslim after reading Malcolm X's autobiography. What effect did that book have on you?
Oh, profound. I really got a lot from observing what Malcolm went through and looking at the world through his eyes and understanding some of the things that he understood, especially as it relates to Black people living in America, it really had a profound effect on me. I couldn't overemphasize how much of an effect that it had at that time.
The man who became your mentor, Hamas Abdul-Khalis, gave you the last part of your name, the Jabbar, and you were very close to him for a while. And you've written over the years about the kind of mixed influence that he had on you. On the one hand, he really taught you a lot about Islam. On the other hand, you came to distrust him. He had basically chosen a wife for you, and you left a woman you loved for her, he wouldn't let you challenge him. Or to go to other texts that might challenge things that he was saying. He kind of went crazy. Seven people in his family had been murdered, and after that he was
definitely a changed man after that, and
yeah.
He kind of went over the edge, I think. I can't comment on his mindset. I haven't questioned him on it, but as far as I could observe, he wasn't the same man after that, and he became very erratic.
Well, he was one of the people who took, I think, three government buildings hostage and held hostages inside. But I guess what I'm wondering is this. Some people after having worked closely with a very charismatic figure who taught them so much about a faith, after, if they felt it necessary to leave that person, they might leave the faith too. And it's clear that you were able to make that distinction between this person, your mentor, and the faith itself. You were able to keep the faith even though you left him.
That's correct. I there was nothing wrong with Islam, but a number of the things that Hamas was teaching us just didn't add up, and I just couldn't keep ignoring it. You know, I tried ignoring it for years, and it just still wouldn't add up. So finally, I decided to test my own wings and be a Muslim on my own, and it's worked out fine.
Your parents were Catholic. What was their reaction when you changed faith?
Oh, they were pretty upset about it. But they also understood that it was a very sincere thing on my part. I wasn't doing it to hurt them or to lash out at anyone. I really believed in it. I still do.
You know, you had said with Ali that you thought what really aggravated people was his stand against the war and not his change of name or his Muslim faith. You took a political stand yourself in, when was the Olympics, 67 or 68?
68, yeah.
That you participated in the boycott,
yeah.
Because you felt that you know, black Americans, African Americans were treated so badly in the States that you didn't want to represent the United States in the Olympics. You can correct me if you want to amplify on what the more specific reason was.
Well, I think you more or less have covered it there.
Well, was taking a political stand frowned on by the NCAA at the time?
The NCAA stayed out of it.
They didn't try to pressure you to change your mind?
Nobody tried to pressure me. I mean, the people at UCLA didn't try to pressure me. I loved them, and they loved me, and I respected them, and they respected me. I had a lot of problems with Avery Brundage and the people in the Olympic Committee. I thought that they were, you know, from the country club set and very insensitive to what was going on, and they were trying to portray the Olympics as not a political event, and I knew better than that.
So no one ever tried to send you a message that taking a political stand was going to be frowned on, if not in college sports and professional sports?
Kirk Douglas called me at my home and told me that I was making a big mistake. But other than that, most people that had any kind of political awareness seemed to understand that I definitely had a valid point. The boycott never really took place. You know, black athletes did go to the Olympics. I didn't go because I was trying to make money so I could finish my senior year at UCLA. And, you know, I had a job, and I didn't want to leave it. And it was as simple as that. But the other guys, Tommy Smith and John Carlos, they went to the Olympics, and they did make a statement. And I think although they were frowned upon here in the United States, around the world, people gave us a lot of respect for voicing our views and letting our position on things be known.
In your new memoir, Kareem, you write about a time in 1964 when you were working in Harlem, spending a lot of time there, and you got off the train one day and stepped into the middle of a riot. White cops had killed a 15-year-old boy who they said was armed, but there was never any evidence found of any kind of weapon. And you write after witnessing this riot that you were going to be black rage personified. Did you ever follow through on that feeling?
Oh, no, I didn't. Fortunately, logic took over, and I had to start realizing that you can't judge people on their color, any people. You know, black people aren't good because they're black, and white people aren't bad because they're white. It's a lot more complicated than that. But, you know, when you're 16 years old, it's very easy to just let your emotions lead you down the wrong path. But, you know, I adjusted to that. I think the thing really in those days that affected me the most was the bombing of the church in Birmingham, Alabama. That really scarred me for a while, and I really had a lot of hatred and resentment in me for several months. But I got over it.
Mm-hmm. I think it was in 1983 that your house burned down.
Yes.
You're right. Your house burned down, and your record collection went with it, and other things that you collected over the years, basically everything you own, went up in flames, though no one was injured.
I ended up with what I had in my suitcases. I was on the road, and all I had left was what I had taken with me on the road.
How did you take that?
It was tough, but it was a good lesson. It was hard to find the silver lining in that cloud, but eventually I did.
What was it?
Well, you know, the things that we own are beautiful and wonderful, but they don't really make our lives good. And if you can understand that, you have definitely grasped the meaning of the important things in life. And, you know, your friends and the people you can relate to, I think that's a lot more important. And I had to have that incident in my life to underline that, but I think I learned that message, and I think I've appreciated more and more of my life ever since then.
Did that stop you from collecting things you loved after the fire?
No, but I definitely got my priorities in order and dealt with things a lot more realistically.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, a lot of fans started sending you records to help you replace your record collection after it got burned up in the fire. And I think you had said that it changed your impression of fans.
Yeah.
What had your impression been before, and how has it changed?
Well, you know, because we were so successful, the fans were on my case just for being successful and being on the Lakers. And, you know, I kind of thought that that's how everybody viewed me. And that wasn't the case. When people saw that I was vulnerable to the same things that they were, they reached out. It was a nice experience.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is my guest. Do you know what your new career is going to be now that you're no longer in the NBA?
Not really. I'm kind of playing it by ear. I have a number of fires in the iron. I've been doing some acting. I'd like to continue to do that. And other things have popped up here and there. It all depends on what makes sense and how I can fit it into my life.
What are the other things you're thinking about?
There's been some offers as far as broadcasting, and I have an ongoing relationship with the LA Gear to represent them, and that's going real well.
Are you going to keep playing basketball at all?
No.
Not at all?
No.
Why not?
Well, I've had enough.
Uh-huh. So you don't miss playing the game at all?
No, I don't. I stay in shape. I enjoy training and stuff, but basketball is not what I need to do to stay in shape, so I do other things.
Do you watch basketball on TV?
Occasionally. I watch the Lakers, and my older son, Kareem, is playing. He played this year, so I'd go to a couple of his games, but that's been it.
Do people recognize you a lot because you are as tall as you are?
Oh, yeah. I can't go anywhere without people not saying some basketball player's name, and then they kind of figure out it's me. But, you know, anybody my height is going to be noticed.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, thank you.
You're
very
welcome.
Much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
And Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's new book, Kareem, is about his last year in the game. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, environmentalist Barry Commoner, he was one of the first scientists to alert us to the environmental costs of our technological development. He now directs the Center for the Biology of Natural Systems and has a new book titled Making Peace with the Planet. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. From 1950 to 1954, one of the highlights of the TV lineup was your show of shows. It made Sid Caesar and Imogene Coca two of TV's first comedy stars. Caesar and Coca are reuniting for a series of shows. Coming up, we meet Imogene Coca. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has some thoughts about today's globe-hopping star conductors. And he reviews a recording by one conductor who gained fame by staying close to home. And pianist Jimmy Rowles remembers singer Sarah Vaughan. She died last night of lung cancer at the age of 66. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter said today that peace in the Middle East is inevitable after a meeting in Paris with PLO leader Yasser Arafat. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Jimmy Carter met Yasser Arafat together with French President François Mitterrand for 40 minutes. Carter said they discussed delays in the Middle East peace process and how to get it going again. The former U.S. president is believed to be on an unofficial mission for U.S. Secretary of State James Baker, who's trying to bring the Israelis and Palestinians to the bargaining table. As part of that campaign, last month, Carter visited Israel, Egypt, Syria, and Jordan. Tonight he said he's hopeful that past delays in the Middle East peace process can now be overcome, and he called for a new push towards negotiations. However, he suggested that the conflict won't be resolved in the near future. He said the main sticking point is that leaders in the Middle East are not following the desire of the people for peace. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Rival Christian factions renewed their fighting in and around Beirut, Lebanon, as efforts continue today to try and work out another ceasefire. At one point, a five-story apartment building was set on fire in a heavily populated area of the city. However, police said that there were no casualties in the blaze because all the tenants were in basement shelters. East German politicians now say that earlier reports of a coalition agreement to form the country's first non-communist government were premature. Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
The coalition talks that began today between the major East German political parties are now expected to last until next week. No coalition agreement was reached during the first round of talks today, but members of all parties said they hope to be able to form a government by April 11th. A coalition between the Conservative Alliance, the Liberal Party, and the Social Democrats would give the government the two-thirds parliamentary majority needed for constitutional changes. The country's newly elected parliament will meet for the first time tomorrow. The head of the leading Christian Democratic Party, Lothar de Maizière, says he does not expect to be elected prime minister until the parliament's second session in mid-April. But de Maizière says he hopes to get the go-ahead from parliament tomorrow to form a government. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
In South Africa, Nelson Mandela says that his meeting with President F.W. de Klerk will help determine if the two sides are ready to begin formal talks on giving blacks a share of power in the country. The talks are also expected to center on ways to end black factional fighting that has killed hundreds of people. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down over 17 points to close at 2,719.37 on volume of some 159 million shares. Trading was moderate. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says the invention of the jet plane has led to the loss of national character, both in music and in conducting. Lloyd has been thinking about this recently because of a newly reissued compact disc with the great Czech conductor Václav Talich.
Some musicians, like Berlioz, achieve their greatest fame away from home. But especially before the age of jet travel, most musicians were little known beyond their native boundaries. Berlioz says in his memoirs that when Beethoven died, he was still virtually unplayed in Paris. Earlier in this century, the great conductors tended not to travel much. Serge Koussevitzky, who conducted the Boston Symphony for 25 years, rarely led other orchestras. Most of his traveling was between Boston and Tanglewood, One common complaint about today's jet-setting conductors is that they don't spend enough time at home. As a result, many orchestras have lost their individual identity. One of the greatest conductors of this century, Václav Talich, was associated mainly with one orchestra, the Czech Philharmonic. He conducted it from 1919 to 1941 and then returned in 1954. He died in 1961. Talich made some recordings in the 78 RPM era and several more after 1954, primarily of music by Slavic composers, Tchaikovsky, Dvorak, Smetana. I haven't seen a Talich recording in a record store in years. Now Supraphon has released the first Talich compact disc, and I hope it's only the tip of the iceberg. Dvorak's Eighth Symphony gets the most loving and natural performance I've ever heard. Between 1935 and 1944, Talich led the Prague National Theater Opera. And as with another great opera conductor, Toscanini, you can hear Talich's love of singing in every phrase. Slavic music has an image problem. We tend to think it's going to be heavy going, a lugubrious goulash with black bread. Dvorak, influenced by Brahms and Wagner, did use dense rather than transparent orchestrations, that is, lots of instruments playing at once. But Western conductors mistakenly overemphasize these thick textures. What they often miss is the inherent lightness of Slavic rhythms. Slavic music is a lot like Slavic speech. In spite of all those thick consonants, the basic inflection isn't a heavy march-like tread, but a dance-like triple meter, dum-titi, dum-titi. The delicacy of this rhythm is in the blood of the great Slavic conductors. Talich's unforced, buoyant performances speak and sing with the real rhythmic life of the Czech language. Here's the third movement of the Dvorak Eighth, Allegretto Grazioso. This new Supraphon disc also includes the Moldau and From Bohemia's Woods and Fields. These are the two loveliest movements from Smetana's Mavlast, his cycle of tone poems depicting the history and landscape of Bohemia. Here's the river Moldau purling through the Czech countryside. Thank you. I gather that Superfun has already scheduled the next Talich release, an album of Dvorak's Slavonic dances. Talich recorded these twice, and probably nobody since Dvorak himself has ever played them better.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. This is Fresh Air. Your Show of Shows was one of the earliest TV variety shows. It ran from 1950 to 1954. Yet it set a standard for comedy on television that shows today are still being measured against. It starred Sid Caesar and Imogene Coca. Carl Reiner and Howard Morris were the supporting players. Mel Brooks, Larry Gelbart, Neil Simon, and Woody Allen all wrote for the show. It reached a new audience in the 70s when 10 of the sketches were repackaged for movie theaters. 10 from Your Show of Shows is now on home video. Imogene Coca and Sid Caesar have reunited several times over the years to perform some of their old sketches. Now they're back together for an open-ended engagement at Michael's Pub in New York that begins in mid-April.
Well, darling, I didn't tell you, but I took the car over to Bill's garage for some minor repairs.
It's funny, I just took it in for a 1,000-mile checker.
Well, I guess they didn't check it up very good.
What's the matter, the car ran a little out of tune or something?
Probably.
Are the brakes slipping?
They slipped.
The windshield is...
There's no windshield.
Are the wheels sort of out of line or something?
They're all kind of out of line. As a matter of fact, the whole car sort of curves, you know.
Now, when you and Sid Caesar reunite, who usually initiates the idea?
Sid.
Why Sid?
I don't know. I would be rather embarrassed calling up Sid and say, "Hey, will you work with me?" You know, it just comes from Sid.
Now, what sketches are you going to do at your performances at Michael's Pub?
Well, the ones I think we're going to do will be a sketch in the movies where he is the innocent bystander and... is in the middle of a terrible argument between a man and a woman. That one we'll probably do. And then we're going to do a pantomime of two people in the percussion section of a large symphony orchestra playing the overture of 1812. And the percussion section is pretty busy in that overture. And, of course, you just see the two of us. You don't see the whole symphony.
You know what I was wondering? When you're doing something like the Innocent Bystander sketch...
Yeah.
Do you remember the sketch completely, or do you both go back and watch 10 from Your Show of Shows to refresh your memory about all the bits in the sketch?
Well, I've been looking at the tape to remind myself of certain bits.
Mm-hmm.
And but hopefully, I found that when we did these three concerts, we would find ourselves adding and doing things that we hadn't done on the tape, something that would come up suddenly while we're playing in front of an audience. And if it seems to work, then we can extend it because we're not watching a clock as you have to do in television, you know? So we find in the sketches new pieces of business.
Now, I think the first TV show that you did was a review in 1949, produced by the same person who produced Your Show of Shows.
Max Liebman. That was the Admiral Review, yes.
Yeah. So when you were on TV in 1949, did you or your family own a television?
No, I didn't own one, but I bought my mother. She was in Philadelphia on Woodland Avenue then, and I bought her a television set on time. And she was the first one on Woodland Avenue with a television set. So all the neighbors came in. I understand the living room was packed with people. And a lot of those ladies had never even seen a show before. So this was a whole new experience for them.
So you couldn't even afford to buy it straight out, huh? You had to buy it on time back then.
Yeah.
So what was your reaction to TV? I mean, most of the people on your mother's block hadn't even owned one, hadn't seen one, and Here you are, one of the first stars of TV. What did you initially think of the medium?
Well, I thought it was very interesting. It was more like doing a Broadway review. You really, literally forgot about the camera until, of course, if I did a single, a song, or something in one, I would very often work into the camera because it was right in front of me. But we had five cameras stationed in all around the theater so that you did not have to be that aware of camera. And we had no cue cards, no applause things, and no warm-up before the show.
Who did your hair?
Well, I did. Sid always had a monologue or a pantomime that lasted exactly 8 minutes. So I would rush up to the dressing room, stick my head in the sink, wash my hair, put a towel around it, take a brush downstairs, and then we'd do the finale, not in costume, of course. And then we'd sit out in the theater, and Max would give out notes. And while he was doing that, I'd brush my hair dry. And so that's what I did.
Now, your hair, I always thought of your hair as being something of your trademark, in a way, one of your many trademarks.
I think I had more male on my hair than I had on my performance. And I was lucky enough to run into a hairdresser who said to me, "Your hair is awful." And I said, it's terrible. And he said, would you trust me? And I said, of course I will. So he washed my hair, and he cut it. Bangs, and he cut it a certain length, and he said, "Now never have another permanent and just brush it dry." And little did I know what a lifesaver, because I am not good about fixing my own hair, and I put on the world's worst makeup. I'm not very good about that sort of thing. But this is the easiest thing in the world to do, just brush your hair dry.
So in the days when you were doing your own hair for TV, let's describe how your hair looked for people who don't remember. You had a kind of round bangs.
Yeah, round bangs, and then it was down slightly below the ear, and I would brush it dry, and it bounced a lot. When I see the tapes now, I think, oh, boy, it bounced, you know. And it was terribly easy to fix. Anybody can do it.
Now, you were from a showbiz family.
Yeah.
What did your parents do?
Well, my father was a third generation of musicians, and when he was very young, he played violin solos with the Philadelphia Symphony, and went from there to conducting for vaudeville. And in the summer, he worked for the Schuberts in one of their theaters in Atlantic City. My mother, she went to New York and went in the chorus of burlesque, which was not quite the same kind of burlesque it is today. And all her sisters followed her, and they all married actors with the exception of one. So had I not gone in the theater, they would have thought I was pretty odd.
Was she a stage mother?
She thought she was. I've seen Gypsy now 3 times, speaking of stage mothers. I love it. But my mother thought she was like the mother in Gypsy, and she would tell her friends, and I went into that agent, and I said to him, she never went into the agents. She sat outside, and while I went in. But my mother liked to think of herself as a much more ferocious kind of mother than she was.
When you were doing TV, you were able to do so many things with your face, you know, in the gestures and the expressions you'd get from your face. Were you doing that on stage when you were starting out too?
I think I was. I think I always have. I think I don't realize I'm doing anything with my face most of the time, and I am conscious now that I use my hands an awful lot, mm-hmm. and I think my face is always. I was a pantomimist without knowing it, but I realize now how much I use my face. I was not conscious of it when I first went in the theater or in television. I never thought about it.
What made you conscious of it?
Well, so many people have written about my face. I've been called rubber-faced and flexible-faced, the face that never stops. So I'm now conscious of it, you know?
After you left your show of shows, you had your own show for a while, the Imogene Coca
yes,
show.
Yes, it wasn't very good.
What was the problem with it?
Well, you can't do a review in a half hour, and I never speak up. I'm not a very good business person, and I'm not a very strong character. And so I did say, I don't think this is going to work, but I don't think anybody heard me.
Now, how much have you been working recently? Would you describe yourself as semi-retired?
No, I haven't. I don't mean that I've been besieged by offers, because that wouldn't be quite true, but I do get offers. But nothing has come up that is really... Another decision I made is I don't want to do anything that I don't feel is going to be fun, or that you're going to be able to get hold of a part and make something out of it, or that you're offered so much money that, you know, and none of those things happen, none of the roles, and the money is not that important, really. And nothing came up that I just wanted to take, so I can't say that I didn't get the opportunities. I didn't think they were very good opportunities.
Now, I know on Moonlighting, I guess this was a couple of years ago.
I forgot Moonlighting, yes.
Yeah, on Moonlighting a couple of years ago, you played Miss DePesto's mother.
Yes.
Really a brilliant piece of casting. There's something about the actress who plays Miss DePesto that is really a little reminiscent of you.
Well, that's what they thought, and that was going to be during a period when Sybil Shepherd was not on the show. She was having the babies, mm-hmm. and Bruce Willis had a major picture. So they... made the show primarily about the secretariat and myself. And I was very pleased with that. I was nominated for an Emmy, to my surprise and delight. And it was a great pleasure to do.
Did you see the connection between your face and hers?
Yes. Yes, I did.
Where are you living now? In New York?
In New York City. I've been here for several years. And, well, a few years ago, my husband passed away, and I've remained in New York.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure being with you.
Imogene Coca will perform with Sid Caesar at Michael's Pub in New York, beginning April 17th. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. What do you have, Linda?
Terry, we're going back to Lithuania to take a look at the negotiations there between officials on the Soviet and Lithuanian side and see if there's any movement. And we have the Soviet point of view with an interview with Gennady Gerasimov. Nine policemen were killed in Colombia. Narco-terrorism seems to be on the increase again there. The governor of Idaho, as you know, vetoed an abortion bill. The advisors who counseled him to do that are apparently under fire now in the state, and we're pursuing a story about that. And we will, of course, be remembering the late Sarah Vaughan.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jazz singer Sarah Vaughan has died of lung cancer at the age of 66. Vaughan was remarkable both for her technique and her artistry. She began her career singing in the Earl Hines and Billy Eckstein bands with some of the musicians who later became pioneers in bop. Her own singing adapted to that musical revolution. Over the years, Vaughan sang to fans in over 60 countries. We phoned pianist Jimmy Rowles, who accompanied Vaughan on and off during the 60s and 70s and who remained a close friend. I asked him what it was about Vaughan that set her apart from other jazz singers.
Well, the voice itself, the instrument, was so fantastic. She had about a 6-octave range. And the quality of the voice, the way she changed her sound, and she was like a flute player or something.
Talk to me about Sarah Vaughan's phrasing.
That's hard to do. Sarah Vaughan's phrasing was like trying to explain Thelonious Monk's phrasing. She she could sing the song just plain simple, and it would be so beautiful you'd cry. Or she could wrench things out of it. She just, it all depended on what mood she was in.
What are some of the ways she would surprise you when you were accompanying her?
Well, sometimes when she'd change keys in the middle of things, just without even letting you know what she was doing, just reach over and push you, you better get your ears going because she was going into another key or something. That would do anything. She was sort of like trying to follow Art Tatum or something like that. Be the bass player for Art Tatum.
Do you have, like, any, like, special memory that you'd like to share with us before we have to wrap up?
Well, the memory I have that always breaks my heart is that one time she came to the house, and this one night she came in and I had a beautiful Steinway grand, and she just went over there and sat down and started making stuff up, just noodling around at the piano. And she played for about a half hour, and she played some of the most beautiful piano I've ever heard. And I had one of those tape recorders lying on top of the piano, and I was so engrossed that I forgot to turn it on. And that, every time I think about that, I think about what a dumb bunny I am.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Well, I hope she's in heaven. If she isn't, I don't know who is.
Pianist Jimmy Rowles. This is Sarah Vaughan, as recorded in 1950.
East of the sun and west of the moon, we'll build a dream house of love.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, environmentalist and one-time presidential candidate Barry Commoner gives his prescription for making peace with our planet. Also, novelist Faye Weldon talks about her latest book, The Cloning of Joanna May, and her best-known book, The Life and Loves of a She-Devil. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.